It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The one-hour international news program, The World, it reaches across borders and time zones. And the program joins the Ideas Network lineup starting Monday at 2. It replaces The Takeaway that is ending production. We get a preview and hear from its host on the work of bringing global events into sharper focus. Call in now with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marco Werman is host of The World, a co-production of PRX and WGBH in Boston. Marco, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's great to be here. I'm really excited, too, that the world is on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah. So literally, welcome to the Ideas Network. Yes, I suppose. So, you know, when it comes to stories about people and issues pertaining to other parts of the globe, how do you help make them resonate with Americans?
I think it's pretty simple. We really go for the human experience and trying to kind of harmonize the experience of people in the United States with those of people around the world. I mean, we all are human beings and we all react to the same things. I think, you know, kind of looking at the impact of policy and politics on people on a daily basis, but also understanding how that policy comes into being. We don't want to do too much explanation. We really want to hear the impact on people, but we also have to understand where, you know, movements and policies and you know, the things that we're seeing in Ukraine, where does that come from? How does that start? And ultimately, what is the effect on people? So we really focus our storytelling on human beings around the world and how they're reacting to everything that we're hearing about. That kind of starts to sound like white noise. But once we connect with actual human beings, then it starts to become real for our listeners.
That human element. You know, there is the Council on Foreign Relations that says we lack knowledge about world affairs. That's not surprising. But many Americans also believe that it affects our daily lives. So why should people in the States care a lot about global issues?
It's a world that appears to have national borders, the world that we live in. But in fact, there's so many things that happen that are happening beyond borders. I mean, starting with the digital world that we started to occupy in the late 1900s, the last century, that meant everything that we do and see that used to be just kind of local is suddenly global. What one does in Wisconsin can be understood and experienced by somebody 10,000 miles on the other side of the world, in India, for example, and vice versa. Global warming, climate change happens without borders, and it's impacting every single person on the planet. We have to understand as Americans how we fit into that whole network of carbon and how we fit into the whole cultural network of the world as well. We, you know, American exceptionalism was a wonderful way to kind of ignore the world for a long time. But, you know, we can't ignore it anymore. And, you know, the more we pay attention to the rest of the world, I think the more we realize we actually are not that exceptional. So I think it's really important to kind of frame our life on planet Earth in that way.
Well, Marco, we're going to do some globetrotting now, and starting in Turkey, where Turkey reelected Recep Tayyip Erdogan for another 5-year term as president on Sunday. And here's a colleague of yours, Duri Buskerin of The World, reporting on the election from a polling station in Istanbul.
After a procedure to check the number of ballots, poll worker Yılmaz Yılmaz takes each one and announces who it's for. He holds the ballot over his head to show the room.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
As he announces the votes, everyone in the room tracks the count on their own sheet of paper. Anyone can object if the vote is unclear or announced incorrectly.
So how do Turkish elections compare to our elections here in America?
Well, for one thing, Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been in power for a couple of decades, either as president or as prime minister. So there's a real dynastic rule to the democracy that he rules over in Turkey. That meant, and we have to recognize too that there's been concern of kind of Putin-like tendencies with Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Would this election be truly free and fair? It seems as if it was fair, but to say it was entirely free kind of ignores the fact that Recep Tayyip Erdogan does have this kind of strongman kind of reputation, and there was concern as that strongman in charge of the incumbent government how actually free the election would be. I mean, there's a lot of state, you know, state media that he can pull and kind of move in his direction. And, you know, it's also concerning. Turkey is a NATO and EU member. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean when you have a you have a strong man like that running an election? It's hard to say whether, you know, he was elected absolutely freely. You know, I think history is going to play that one out.
But were there outside influences, like be it from Russia or the U.S., were there any influences on this election from, you know, the global community?
It's hard to say. I mean, there hasn't been any kind of like really kind of egregious headlines mm-hmm. pointing that direction. Again, it's really about how a strongman accumulates power and what that means when you actually come up to an election where, you know, it was a nice edge on the first round and, you know, fairly seemingly decisive with Erdogan in the second round. And if we look at his opponent, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, he was actually really kind of changing his tone in the weeks between the first round and the second round. He seemed to be something of a moderate. Erdogan wanted to basically kick out a lot of Syrian refugees, and Kılıçdaroğlu before the first round was saying, we're a welcoming country. We want these people who are running away from war and fear in Syria. As soon as the first round happened, he kind of changed his tune and became much more like, you know, much more nationalistic, much more kind of protectionistic, and, you know, telling people we need to send these refugees back. We can't, you know, our economy can't, you know, support this. So it's really interesting how that all changed in the matter of weeks.
Turning back for a moment to Duri Bouskaran's story, a scuffle breaks out between voters and Duri switches to recording on their cell phone. How does your team plan for safety while reporting across the globe?
It's such a great question. You know, we're not a program that sends people into war zones. That is, you know, a proposition that really requires a massive budget. You need a massive security detail. You need constant plans to get people out of harm's way. If there's an injury, how are you going to evacuate them? When we send people to places like Ukraine right now, obviously they have to go through what we call HEFAT, hazardous environment, first aid, emergency training, in case anything happens. We don't send them to the front line. We only go where, when we hire a security a consultant, where they tell us to go. We had our correspondent Shirin Jafari in Afghanistan just before the fall, the Taliban marched back into Kabul in 2021. Mm. You know, we had a very careful extraction plan set up. Fortunately, Shirin was not in harm's way. She was in and out before the Taliban actually arrived in Kabul. But we take extremely close, you know, we take extreme care for all our reporters. And generally, we do not put them in harm's way. It's something that it's a risk just not worth taking.
Marco Werman with us, host of the public radio program The World, as we look at international news and the world coming to the Ideas Network lineup. You can join in with a question at 800-642-1234. Marco, we are going to go to Afghanistan now. You know, 2 years ago, around 13,000 people from Afghanistan, they arrive at Wisconsin's military base, Fort McCoy, after American withdrawal of troops. And, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is reporting about 850 refugees were resettled in our state. What is the immigration status of Afghan refugees in America?
I would suspect that if you ask most Afghan refugees in the U.S. About their current status, they would probably kind of say we're anxious. There are some 70,000 total Afghan refugees here on temporary protected status. That status was for 2 years, so 2021 plus 2 years. That's going to run out in September. The numbers that you just cited from Wisconsin, Kate, pretty much track how it is nationally. About out of those 70,000 here on temporary status, some 5,000, only 5,000, have been resettled. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, very aware of this, sponsored the Afghan Adjustment Act, which got bogged down in Congress. Apparently, Republicans wanted to see more vetting procedures for possible security risks. But right now, it sounds like Senator Klobuchar is trying to reach across the aisle and get some kind of waiver, some kind of extension for these 70,000 people past September. But as I said, I mean, a lot of them are really anxious. And they're working menial jobs if they can get them, and just trying to get by until something shakes loose in Washington. It's a really they're in limbo.
In limbo. Marco Werman with us, host of the international news program, The World, that originates from the WGBH newsroom in Boston. And as we explore the show, what it illuminates as it joins the Ideas Network lineup on Monday. Be part of this conversation about global issues. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The international news magazine, The World, is this daily profile of the most pressing developments across the globe. The one-hour public radio program is coming to the Ideas Network schedule starting Monday at 2, and we have its host with insights on where the show might take us and why it matters. And your comments and questions, they're welcome throughout. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Marco Werman is host of The World. That's a co-production of PRX and WGBH in Boston. Marco, you've been with The World from its start, now going on nearly 30 years ago, it being launched. From that perspective, across the decades, is international news receiving better care and attention now than in past decades? What do you notice?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I start, obviously with what I know best, and that's our program. I think, we landed at a really interesting time when news bureaus, news organizations around the world were actually shutting down their bureaus. Notably commercial television news in the United States, running bureaus in a place like Paris was costing like $1 million a year. And there is a real kind of downsizing of that. And at the same time, in 1995, digital media really started kind of to grow and then obviously exploded with, the advent of social media, newspapers finding ways to kind of go from paper to screens and setting up paywalls. But in the process, I think, digital has made foreign news, especially these little niche areas of foreign news, much more accessible. And we're finding journalists in places as, remote as Burkina Faso and Yemen, where we rarely got news unless you were really kind of super interested in a geographic region. There were not many ways to get news from there. Now there are myriad ways to get that news. Of course, it's really important to know your source and know how reliable and accurate and fair that source is. So we've gone from, trusted kind of legacy sources to each one of us as an individual news consumer figuring out who's right, who's wrong, who can you trust? So it's been really interesting. But I think on balance, international news has been well served by the passage of time.
We're going to turn now to Russia's war on Ukraine. And you spoke with Ukrainian-American pastor Alex Zaitsev, who led a congregation in the frontline city of Avdiivka. And the pastor still makes these occasional dangerous trips to deliver humanitarian supplies. Let's take a listen.
The biggest needs right now are shovels. Because of the amount of use, they tend to break before they're able to requisition and get a new one. But they have to be digging trenches. And another thing is power banks for them to be able to charge their phones, to be able to talk to their families, or hand warmers, foot warmers, sleeping bags, those kind of things.
Tell us about this pastor, Pastor Zaitsev.
Yeah, I'm really glad you pulled this out as an example, Kate, because it gives me a chance to really kind of shine some light on our producers, who are an amazing bunch and incredibly resourceful. Joyce Hackle has been really our producer, kind of running the kind of gauntlet on finding these human voices like Pastor Alex Zaitsev in Ukraine. Joy actually is a native, people from Wisconsin or Wisconsinians?
Wisconsinites, sure, go ahead.
Wisconsinites. She graduated from UW-Madison and grew up in Little Chute, Wisconsin, born there. And Joy, since 2014, with that first Russian invasion of Crimea, had already been working the phones and getting in contact with, you know, as I said, you know, humans who are going through this war experience. She met a Ukrainian named Anna Sandalova in 2014. I spoke with her a couple of times. Anna was ferrying aid at the time to Ukrainian fighters in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine. And then when things started ratcheting up in January 22, Joy reached out to Anna again, asked for contacts, anybody she knew in the country who was, you know, going to be on the front lines. She then put her in touch with another woman who we actually spoke with. She was actually helping us record an interview with a pregnant woman in the subway in Kyiv, who was actually giving birth. Anyway, Maya had worked with Alex Zaitsev and gave Joy his contact. So it's really this constant, like our producers are constantly just, you know, do you know somebody? If you don't know somebody, might they know somebody who knows somebody?
Trying it's to get to the next contact.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Joy got in touch with Alex January a year ago. He actually at the time did not think the Russians were going to invade. That kind of set the frame for just how he got intensely engaged. A really brave individual. You know, if he gets to a bombed out bridge, he finds a way of getting around it and getting help to people in this town that's been under siege. And, you know, he's tried to coax people out, like old women who, you know, are maybe infirm and can't leave. Others who are just too scared to leave their basement. And we talked about that at length, like how frustrating and how sad that is to try and get somebody to get out and save their own life. And for any number of reasons, they don't want to go. Alex is not only just a powerful kind of human being in his own experience and what he does, but he's great at conveying the feelings of others, which, you know, when you're doing radio and you want to try and obviously interview a few people in their local language, it's great to have somebody who's like really dialed in to the emotion of the moment and can help you understand that. Mm. And Alex does that.
Power of the human voice. Before we move on, just some context with the Donbas region. Why is this area such a flashpoint in the war?
I mean, it goes back to, I think, what Moscow sees as its rightful kind of empire. And essentially anything that kind of radiates out from the Kremlin that used to be Soviet or Russian, Putin sees as his kind of rightful ownership. Mm-hmm. And so this first incursion into eastern Ukraine was the start of that. And if you ask Ukrainians when the war started, they will not say February 24th, 2022. They will say it started with Putin's annexation of Crimea. And as you know, listeners to the Ideas Network will know, you know, this is existential for both Ukraine and for Russia. Ukraine wants all of its territory back. Russia says it's historically ours. That's a construct that Putin has made up, and you know, there are very few people except for his immediate kind of proximate lieutenants who seem to believe that. Probably a lot of Russians who have bought the propaganda at this point as well.
We only have about a minute left, but can you tell us about any stories or places you're excited about pursuing next?
Well, one of the big things we really kind of embrace to get us away from the doom and gloom, because we could easily fill up a whole hour of the show looking at Ukraine, Sudan, Myanmar, what's happening in the Sahel, Afghanistan, Syria. But, you know, that's not the entire world. The world is filled with moments of discovery and innovation, and, you know, the things that make life great, food, music, and language. So we're actually starting in the next couple of weeks, marking the 50th anniversary of hip hop, which is something that really blew up internationally in a way pretty much after, you know, our show started in 1995. And it was really extraordinary to see how this musical genre that started in the South Bronx with, you know, with roots in Jamaica and in Kingston, Jamaica, really moved across the world as a form of really democratic and artistic expression. So we're going to be looking at hip hop in many places and in many themes. Well, this summer. So be on the lookout for that.
Marco, thank you for joining us.
Kate, it was an absolute pleasure. Can't wait to be on the air with you.
Marco Werman, host of The World. That's a co-production of PRX and WGBH in Boston. It joins the Ideas Network lineup starting Monday at 2. It replaces The Takeaway that is ending production. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.